We're going to be in our Bibles in the book of Genesis this morning, or this evening. If you want to turn your Bibles to Genesis chapter 6, we're going to be looking at the flood tonight. Genesis chapter 6. It starts off, "And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with men forever, for he is indeed flesh, and yet his days shall be 120 years. Now, some people think that that's God limiting the age of men, because at this time, as we saw last week, men lived several centuries, and it was the average age of over 900 of the ages that are given to us in the text. I don't think that's what God is doing here. I think he's saying that within 120 years, the age of man on earth is going to end, because his spirit is not going to dwell with them forever. You know, the first time we saw the Holy Spirit was in Genesis chapter 1, and he was in connection with the creation of the earth. And now the second time we see the Holy Spirit is in chapter 6, where it's in connection of his destruction of that same thing. And it says in verse 4, there were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. And those were mighty men who were of old, and men of renown. Probably not much need for much commentary on this passage. I'm sure we all pretty much understand it fully, don't we? I mean, you could probably all just explain that verse in very much detail. No, seriously, I think that in my own mind, in my own life, there's several different theories as to what the text is saying in Genesis 6:4. And in varying degrees, I've probably held to each one of them at different points in my life. It's kind of a controversial subject, probably too controversial for its own good. I don't think it was something that God ever intended that it be this much of a thing to debate about it. But to begin with, as we try to unpack this verse, the word giants here in the text is the word Nephilim. And it literally means, it's the noun form of the Hebrew verb to fall. And so most of the Bible guys would say literally it means the fallen ones. It doesn't mean giants. It means the fallen ones. Now, some people could say, well, the bigger they are, the harder they fall, and that could be the idea behind this. There is a word for giants that is used in other places of the Old Testament, but that's not the word that is used in Genesis chapter 6. The reason why it's translated as giants is because in the Septuagint translation, the Greek translation of the Old Testament that happened in the 1st and 2nd centuries B.C., they translate it by the Greek word gigantes. And that's where the idea, when it was first translated into English, to carry that idea over as giants. It may be talking about giants. I don't know. But what it says is that they were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. There's three main theories on to exactly what the identity of, talks about the sons of God and the daughters of men. Who were these two groups of people? Who were the sons of God and the daughters of men? Primarily, the misunderstanding or the debate is over who identifies as the sons of God. One view is that they were powerful kings and they were practicing forced harems. You know, they just took of the daughters of men of whom they chose. They were very powerful world leaders, and they saw a woman, and they liked her, and they just took her and made them part of their harem. You know, that's possible. It could be. It doesn't seem, I mean, powerful kings have been doing that for the millennia since then, and it hasn't made given rise to a cause to destroy the earth again in such a way. So we don't really see why that would be such a, that's a bad thing, but there's a lot badder things going on than that. Another view is that it's the godly line of Seth, the sons of God are the godly line of Seth, and the daughters of men are the ungodly line of Cain. But the question then would be, why would their offspring, you know, unequally yoked people, if you will, why would their offspring produce these giants or these Nephilim that would cause God to want to destroy the world. Secondly, why is it the godly line of Seth, or the men are the godly line of Seth and the women are the ungodly line of Cain? Why couldn't you have an ungodly line from Seth and a godly descendant of Cain? It doesn't really seem to fit the narration or the purpose behind it. And then the third view is that the sons of God are the fallen angels who have decided to come down and cohabitate with human women. The strength of any of these three views is primarily given on the weakness of the other ones. You know, in other words, they've all got their weaknesses, and the one with the least weaknesses seems to be the cream that rises to the top. And depending upon what circles you're in, you can say one is the majority opinion, but it kind of depends on what circle you're in as to whether that's the case or not. I don't really know among evangelicals which is the priority position. But the term sons of God in Hebrew is the phrase B'nai Elohim. And it only occurs in Genesis chapter 6 and then in the book of Job. Job chapter 1 and chapter 2, where God calls this council of the sons of God to come together. And, you know, that's when he asked Satan, what have you been up to? And Satan says, I've just been going around seeing who I can mess with. And then also in chapter 38 of Job, where Job demands of God an answer as to why he's going through all this trialing. And in chapter 38, verse 7, God says the sons of God had shouted for joy. He's asking Job, where were you when the sons of God shouted for joy? Obviously, in chapters 1 and 2, it's talking about angelic beings, and it would be very contextual to think that chapter 38 of Job is talking about the same thing. Most people, the general consensus is that Job was written, the author of Job was Moses, that it was written during, even though it predates Moses by 500 or 600 years, it was probably written down for us by Moses. And if he used the phrase B'nai Elohim in one time to refer to the angels, it would be a logical thing that he would do so in Genesis 6 also. That would be one of the strengths for the position of it being the fallen angels who come down and cohabitate with women. One of the verses that's oftentimes used against that is Matthew chapter 22, verse 30, where Jesus says to the people, the Sadducees are kind of questioning him about that guy that got married, or that woman that was married seven times to seven brothers, and they all died, and which one will be your husband in heaven? And he says, you don't know the scriptures, you don't know what you're talking about. But in verse 30 of Matthew 22, he says, for in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like the angels of God in heaven. So it says that in heaven, the angels don't do that sort of thing. You know, they don't get married. They're not given in marriage. They don't do the marriage thing. It doesn't say that they can't, though, would be something somebody would come back with. You know, there's no place in the Bible that says they can't do that. Jesus just says in heaven, they don't do that. And my question to that would be, even though I kind of lean to this position, my question to that would be, where do angels get some sort of procreative abilities? You know, they're non-corporeal spirit beings. You know, they don't have flesh and blood. They're not three-dimensional in the sense that the physical creation is. And so where would they get the ability to be able to raise offspring through procreation? A couple of verses that kind of might shed a little light on it is in the book of Job in the sixth verse. Job 1:6 says, and the angels who did not keep their proper domain but left their own abode, he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day. And this has led some people to believe that what Job is talking about is the angels that were participants in this whole Genesis thing, catastrophe, that those fallen angels, those demons, those evil spirits, and in my belief is that they're all three the same thing, fallen angels, demons, evil spirits are all the same burger heads, and that they were the ones that participated in that, and they were assigned to the everlasting chains of darkness down in the abuso, the bottomless pit, until their judgment on the great day. It appears as though Peter, in his second epistle, has something similar in mind, where he says in 2 Peter 2:4, For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into the chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment. So it appears as though Peter is talking about the same group of angels and the same event. Whatever it was that they did, they did not stay in their assigned abode or their proper domain. They left that and came down in sin. God didn't spare them, so Peter's point is, how much more do you think you won't be spared? The word hell here in 2 Peter 2:4 is not the normal word for hell, whether it would be Hades, which means a place where dead people go, or Gehenna, which was Jesus' word to describe the lake of fire. It's neither one of those two words. It's the word tartarao, which is actually the noun, the verb form of the Greek noun Tartarus. And it's the only place it occurs in the New Testament. Tartarao is only here. Tartarus doesn't occur. Tartarao is only here. And it's the verb form of the Greek noun Tartarus, which could be translated hell. In Greek mythology, Tartarus was the place of judgment for the Titans. If you're familiar from Greek mythology from school, when you're reading some of the stories, they were the second generations, the second and third tier gods after Zeus and the primary gods. Then they were like the offspring of the gods. They were like demigods, the Titans were. And that it was the place where Zeus confined them to for judgment because he was threatened by them. He was jealous of them. And so he sent them to this, the lowest, furthest reaches of Hades was a place called Tartarus. And that's what the word is in Greek mythology. As Peter uses it here in 2 Peter chapter 2, he uses the verb form of it. He's saying for if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell, literally saying he didn't spare the angels who sinned, but he hellified them. You know, it's the verb form of it, by throwing them into these chains of darkness. So is Peter validating Greco-Roman theology when he says this? Is he like, you know, hey, the Greeks got it right, you know, that the Titans are the same people as the demons, and they're thrown in judgment until, or in chains until that judgment-like day. Is Peter validating all that? More likely, it's that Greek mythology validates Peter. More than likely, I mean, you know, we're only a couple of generations removed from the flood when you think that the generations were almost a millennium long. We're only a couple of generations removed from that. And, you know, when the guys come off of the boat, they were all Yahweh worshipers. They knew why the flood had happened. And within a couple of generations, it had denigrated to this place of debauchery that were with idolatry and so forth. So the early pagans probably had some vestige of the truth of what had happened, the backstory of the flood. And it would just had been passed down from Noah to the time of Moses even into the New Testament times. How about maybe a combination of all three of those theories, though? If you just kind of put them all together, you had these demon-possessed men, you know, bad guys on earth who become demon-possessed, so there they would have their impetus, they would have their power to go do the will of the enemy, and they also had the physical capabilities of procreation. And so it's demon-possessed men who were forcing themselves upon women, and this is 1,600 years past after the Garden of Eden, okay? So 1,600 years later, Satan has been trying to raise up this race of super bad guys. They were humans, but they were the result of demon-possessed men doing the thing that they did. And he was trying to, the super race of giants, if you will, the super race of Nephilim. It's kind of like, you know, Hitler's dream was to do the same thing, wasn't it? He wanted to get rid of everything but the Aryan race, and that was his desires, that through that he had this vision of creating this super race. Well, this was Hitler's dream on steroids. You know, that he could just have, Satan could get these demon-possessed guys who were in line with the desire to have evil rule in the world, and they could just raise up generation after generation after generation of those that were like-minded, and they would somehow take over the world in that fashion. At any rate, you know, I think we've already spent too much time talking about it, but at any rate, whatever it was, it involved sexual sin. We can see that. And so then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. You know, the word intent in the Old King James is the word imaginations. You know, it's just like all they would do is just sit around and think what kind of evil they could come up with. And it says that the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. When it says that the Lord was sorry, you know, the Bible oftentimes uses this as what's called anthropopathic terms. Anthropopathic, and this is an anthropopathic term for God, it's giving human emotions to God. If you look the word anthropopathic up, and I did, if you look that up in the dictionary, the Webster says that it's the assignment of human feelings or passions to something not human as a deity or an animal. You know, we'll do the same thing with our pet goldfish. You know, if we're feeling sad, we'll think that they're feeling sad also. We try to pass those human emotions on to them. And this is what Moses was doing for God, to somehow try to express in human terms the depth of what the Lord was feeling. His overwhelming emotion was that of sorrow and grief. He was so bummed at what these men that he created in his own image had become. So the Lord said in verse 7, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping things and birds of the air, for I'm sorry that I have made them. The Old King James says that it repenteth me that I have made them. Well, God doesn't repent in the sense that we understand the English definition of the word. It's just meaning that he was just kind of bummed out about how things had happened. I like the New Living Translation. While it may be somewhat of a paraphrase of the passage, it does capture the heart, where it says, so the Lord was sorry that he'd ever made them and put them on the earth. It broke his heart. And I think that's what the text is saying. But then it says in verse 8, but Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. You know, in the midst of all of this darkness and all of this brokenheartedness on the Lord's part, it says that Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Noah is mentioned 50 times in 9 different books of the Bible, not just simply in the book of Genesis. I mean, Moses has a big role in the Bible. And I think one of the biggest things that we can draw from this is that Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. You know, grace was the way of the Old Testament as well as the way of the New Testament. Now, if you got another modern English translation, it'll say favor, that Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. But I think it's the same thing with regards to God. Our relationship to him, whether it's through favor or through grace, it's the same thing. It's something that he extends to us that we don't deserve. And, you know, it could be said, and I've read some commentators, that says Noah is a type of the end times believer. You know, as we see ourselves living in the end times, and we can look at Moses, and we can say, well, he's a type of the same sort of era that we live in. But he's not a type of the end times believer. He was an end times believer. I mean, the days in which Noah lived were the end times. You know, we live, I believe, in the end times, but that doesn't mean the end of everything. That doesn't mean the end of existence. It's kind of the beginning of existence in a lot of ways, but we are definitely in the end of this era as Moses or Noah. I'm probably going to say Moses instead of Noah more than once tonight. And if you guys laugh, that's just going to show that you're carnal. You know, Noah was an end times believer just as we are. And you know, it's sometimes, we can be very overwhelmed by stuff in this life. You know, I mean, it can get just, you know, we look at all the depravity and all the junk that's going on, and it can be pretty depressing. And it can be pretty hard to toe the line. You know, sometimes it can be pretty hard to man up and be the kind of men and women that God has called us to be. But if Noah could do it in the times in which he lived with what he had, with what he was equipped with, you know, he didn't have much of the Bible. He didn't have the indwelling presence of the Holy Spirit to empower him to live. He wasn't regenerated in the sense that New Testament believers are. And if Noah could do it, if he could be called a man of righteousness, then we can definitely do it. And this is the genealogy of Noah. Verse 9, Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God. Now, when it says that he was perfect in his generations, doesn't mean he was flawless or sinless. It just means that the word perfect in the Bible has the idea of being mature or complete. And he was a grown-up man of God. You know, he wasn't just a newbie trying to feel his way out on what this whole walking with God is. He walked with God, it says. Why did he find grace and not the others? I mean, he was a sinner just like his next-door neighbors were, but Noah walked with God. Noah found grace in God's eyes because he walked with him. and he lived for the righteous things of God. And it says Noah begot three sons. There were Shem and Ham and Japheth. And the earth was also corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, and all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. You know, can you imagine what it was? I mean, as God saw this, after Adam and Eve had been kicked out of the Garden of Eden, and then Cain had killed his brother, and then there was year after year and decade, and then it turned into centuries, and then, millions of people, if not billions of people, were upon the earth. And it says their minds, their intentions were always on evil continually. That's all they ever thought about. And there was a point in all this, as God was watching this and striving, his spirit was striving with men, trying to bring them back to a place of righteousness. There was a place in that where God said, enough, no more. The line has been crossed. Enough is too much. And where is that place? You know, of course, we'll never know. I fully understand that I'm old. You know, I get that. And I talk about things that happened a long time ago. I get that. And a lot of you hear me talking about things that happened a long time ago, and you think, man, he really is old. But I go back to the days when Ricky and Lucy slept in separate beds. You know, I mean, that's the way it was on TV back then. And I can remember as a kid watching I Love Lucy and thinking that they didn't have a very good marriage because they slept in separate beds. You know, they must have been fighting all the time or something. I didn't know any different. But it was such a time of, and I mean, you know, and I'm still alive. I mean, this was in my lifetime that it was that way. And now we have homosexuals kissing on TV. You know, when I was a child, they didn't know what a homosexual was. And now we have homosexual men and women on TV, and that's just the TV commercials. You know, that's before we start talking about the primetime comedies and drama. I mean, you know, when is God going to say that's enough? When is God going to say we've crossed the line and he's had all he can stand and he can't stand no more? You know, I mean, do we really need to have stats on pornography or teen violence or out-of-wedlock pregnancies? You know, is that going to make us understand how messed up the world is anymore? Do we need to talk about the rise in drug usage and the gang activities, not only in the inner cities, but even in the rural communities now? And, you know, the big news currently is the whole opiate addiction that is so epidemic across our country. You know, how about the steady increase in the sleazy entertainment media and the idea, the line that they throw out that all they're doing is just reflecting culture and they do what they do in the name of free speech. How much eviler do we have to get before God will say, that's enough? Well, God said to Noah in verse 13, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth. So make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and then cover it inside and outside with pitch. We don't know what gopher wood is. Most likely it was probably cypress or cedar wood. You know, those both can withstand prolonged water very easily without rotting. And so it was most likely one of those two or a type of those kind of trees. We don't know exactly what kind of trees they had in the antediluvian era. But it says, I want you to build it with rooms. And the word, every other time this word is used in the Old Testament, it's translated as nests. It talks about the birds with their nests. The word rooms or cells is the understanding of the word. And it would be the picture of, you know, I want you to take this ark that you're going to build and then honeycomb it with little cubby holes to put the animals in. And then I want you to cover it within and without, on the inside and the outside, with pitch. And the word pitch is the word kofar, which is the same word as, you know, he says cover it with pitch. Those are the two same words. I mean, literally what he's saying is pitch it with pitch or cover it with covering. It's related to the word kafar, which is the Hebrew word for atonement. In the Old Testament, under the law, if you will, atonement meant a covering over of the sin. That's why they had to always sacrifice another animal. That's why they had to continually every year have the Day of Atonement, because they could only cover up their sins for a period of time. And this speaks of that. You know, the ark is going to be pitched within and without. It's going to be kafared within and without with a covering, as Noah's sins would be covered over, as Noah and his family's sins were covered over during the time of God's judgment. And he says, this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, and its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. Well, thanks a lot for that information, God. That helps us out quite a bit. Generally, it's believed that, in fact, the biblical cubit was 18 inches. It's the distance from your elbow to your fingertips. And it's generally believed to be a foot and a half, 18 inches. That's the biblical cubit. But this is before the flood. This is before they had a biblical anything. You know, I mean, this is back in the, this is a long time ago. And what if it was the distance between the elbow and the fingertip was measured from a Nephilim point of view? You know, that could have been a yard or something. But generally thinking that if a cubit is 18 inches, that would make the ark 450 foot long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. And then it was going to be four stories. There was going to be the deck, and then there would be three stories underneath that. That would give it a total of over 1.5 million cubic feet inside it. This is a big old thing, this ark, big thing. And like I said, that's based upon an 18-inch cubit. The Babylonian cubit, for example, was over 22 inches. So there's a lot of people that think that the cubit could have been much more, which an inch or two here and there, when you're talking about this size of things, could really increase the size of the boat quite a bit. And if it was a 22-inch cubit, that would raise the cubic feet to over 2,200,000. Remember the Weebles? When you're a kid, of course you guys don't. Some of you do. You remember Weebles. You know, the Weebles, they wobble, but they won't fall down. Well, that's what the ark was, okay? It was a big floating Weeble. But it wasn't made to stand upright on the earth. It was made to stand upright in the water. And the way it was designed, the way God had instructed Noah to do this, I almost said Moses. The way that God had instructed Noah to do this was to make it so that no matter how much of a pitch it got from the waves, no matter how big the storm would go, the thing would continue to be upright. It was like a 5,000-year-old gyroscope kind of design. And it says, and you shall make a window in the ark. The reason for that is so the giraffe would have a place to stick his head out. You know, all the Sunday school pictures of the ark, and you always got the giraffe with his head sticking out the window. So that's why they had to have a window. But he said, make a window in the ark, and then you shall finish it. That's not really why. I hope nobody's taking notes on that. But you shall finish it to a cubit from above, and then set the door of the ark on in its side, and you shall make it lower, second, and third decks. And behold, I myself am bringing floodwaters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh in which is the breath of life, and everything that is on the earth shall die. Now remember, most likely, and I believe this to be true, the Bible's a little bit ambivalent about this, but most likely it had never rained up to this point. You know, we saw in Genesis chapter 2 that the water, the mist just came up from the ground, and that's how it was kind of like this big greenhouse sort of effect. And most likely that was the way it was up until the time we get to Genesis 6. It had never rained. There were no oceans. You know, whatever kind of floating crafts that they had were probably little dugout canoes, most likely. You know, sometimes I'll be talking to people, and I'll get to discussing about the end times or something like that, and they start asking questions about it, and I'll describe it, and they says, you mean that you actually believe that the day is going to happen when sometime all the Christians are going to be immediately taken off of the earth, and any Christian airline pilots, the plane's going to crash, any Christians that are driving a car, the car's going to crash, and there's going to be all these people disappear, and then worldwide going to have all this catastrophe happen instantaneously, and then you're going to believe, you actually want to tell me that there's going to be 7 years of this unprecedented horror upon the earth, and you're going to have these demon-like locusts that come out of a huge pit in the ground, and they're going to sting people for 6 months, but they won't kill them, and people are going to long to die, but they won't be able to. You actually believe that's going to happen? And I'll go, yeah, that's kind of what I believe. And it sound, you know, it does sound kind of fanciful. I mean, it sounds kind of like, I just made that word up. It does sound like, I mean, could anybody really believe that could be a reality? Well, yeah, I do believe that. Rain, 5,000 years ago, sounded just as weird. It sounded just as hard. It was just as ridiculous to the guys in Noah's day as us talking about the rapture is in our day. I mean, Friday nights, all of Noah's neighbors would grab their lawn chairs and come over and pull these keggers while they watched and made fun of Noah and his sons as they were banging on the ark. And you know, every once in a while, they'd maybe pull out an umbrella just to kind of mock him a little bit. You know, I fell to drop. You know, I mean, just the idea that rain was just an inconceivable concept to them. And he says to him in verse 18, I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark and keep them alive with you. And they shall be male and female, the birds after their kind, animals after their kind, and every creeping thing of the earth after its kind. And two of every kind shall come with you to keep them alive. You know, God is saying to Noah, I'm going to stick Moses in here somehow. God was saying to Noah, I'm going to make the animals come to you. You don't even have to go out and herd them up. I'm going to make them come to you. I hope the three-toed sloth was kind of in the proximity. You know, I mean, could you imagine how long that would have taken him to get there? Or the slugs or the snails. But he says, I'll bring them into the ark, and then you shall take for yourself of all the food that is eaten and gather it for yourself, and then it shall be food for you and for them. And then the most important verse in the whole chapter, thus Noah did, according to all that God commanded him, so he did. You know, Jesus goes on to say in Matthew chapter 24, starting with verse 27, as the days of Noah were, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them away, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. You know, whenever this happens, whenever Jesus does call us to be with him, to gather with him in the air, to be with him for all eternity, whenever Michael's trumpet is blown, it's going to be just business as usual. I mean, in the middle of all of the depravity and in the middle of all of the evil that will be so proliferated across the earth, it's going to be just, today is going to be just like yesterday. And the expectation that tomorrow will be just like today. And that's what Jesus is saying, because that's the way it was with these guys back then. They thought it was just life. It was just normal. It's the way it's always going to be until the day that it happened. And the Lord said to Noah in verse 1 of chapter 7, come into the ark, you and all your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. My New King James says, God says to Noah, come. If you got the New American Standard, you have God saying to Noah, enter. Or if you got the NIV, it's God saying to Noah, go. And you think, how can we get the... Actually, that Hebrew word can mean all three things. It can mean come, enter, or go. It depends on the stem it's in. And in the stem, the kale stem that this word always occurs in, it always means come. And I think that's significant because God isn't telling us to go into the ark. He's saying, come into the ark, because he's there. He's already there, you know, and he's inviting us to come and join him. God doesn't promise us that we won't have storms, but he has promised that he'll be with us in the midst of the storms. And I think that's encapsulated in this one single little word. As he's calling Noah to come into the ark before the judgment begins. And you shall take with you seven of each of every clean animal, a male and his female, two each of animals that are unclean, a male and his female, and also seven each of the birds of the air, male and female, to keep the species alive on the face of all the earth. Now, my question would be, how did Noah know which were the clean and the unclean animals? You know, did he watch them bathe? I mean, you know, how did he know which ones? Because, I mean, in the law that will come several hundred years later, They're told what the clean and unclean animals are, but how did Noah know that? Something had been passed down, something that, you know, I believe would go all the way back to the Garden of Eden when God had made those animal skins for Adam and Eve. Something had been passed down from then all the way down to Noah, that they were instructed on the ways of sacrifice and what animals would be appropriate and what hadn't and what weren't. For after 7 days, notice this, he's going to bring Noah and his family and all the animals into the ark and close the door, and in 7 days before the rain starts, for in seven more days I will cause it to rain on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights, and I will destroy from the face of the earth all living things that I've made. And so Noah did all that the Lord commanded him, and Noah was 600 years old when the flood waters were on the earth. You know, it's like God was giving the people one more week to repent, you know, before the judgment actually began. And, you know, the whole time they're in there, they're out there in their lawn chairs and their big mugs of beer, and they're going, you Bible or boat-thumping fundamentalist, you know, and just making fun of him. And no one thought that their sin, their own, you know, they could see why their neighbor would get judged, but nobody thought that their sin was going to be bad enough to be judged. And so Noah, with his sons, his wife, and his sons' wives, went into the ark because of the waters of the flood. Now, scholars, both secular and Christian, argue several things, details about regarding the flood. Primarily, it falls into one of two things. They debate the timing of the flood, when did it happen, and they will also argue over the extent of it. Was it a local flood or a universal flood? And most of the ones that hold to a local flood will say something about, well, no, even the Christians that would, you know, you hear this in a lot of seminaries today, and you'll say, well, to Noah, what happened was universal because it was the extent of what he knew. He didn't know the world was 20,000, 25,000 miles in diameter. He didn't know it was that big. So it was his global flood, but that's not what the Bible teaches, nor is it what I think science reveals. You know, time, as well as the limitations of my tiny brain, would prevent us from looking at all of the arguments point by point in comparison the pros and cons of the different viewpoints. But just hopefully I can highlight a couple of them that would give us some takeaways with regards to this whole thing about was the flood literal. And I hope they'll suffice to show that the flood was universal and that it happened probably around 5,000 years ago. The word flood is the Hebrew word mabul. And it only occurs in Genesis 6 through 9, the narration account of the flood, and then one verse in Psalms 29 where it's a reference to the flood. There are eight other Hebrew words that could be used to translate flood, but the word mabul, sometimes it's some Bibles translate the word deluge because it's not your normal average kind of, it's not a Mississippi River kind of flood. The ancient flood accounts are, they're global. I was reading today about Polynesian islands, Africa, South America, the North America, Alaska, as well as all corners of Europe and Eastern and Southern Asia. They all have, over 200 ancient cultures have flood accounts. So I think it's pretty safe to say that it's universal just from that standpoint alone. And he says in verse 8, of the clean animals, of animals that are unclean, of birds and everything that creeps on the earth, two by two, they went into the ark to Noah, male and female, as God had commanded Noah. Yeah, perhaps maybe you've seen this comparison. There's hundreds of websites that show this comparison. And it's a thing that's got a picture of the Titanic on the left and then the Ark on the right. And then they compare the two of them as far as their various stats go. The Titanic was a height of 175 versus 45 feet for the Ark. Titanic was 882 feet long versus half that with the Ark of 450, and width was 92 versus 75. The construction of the Titanic was steel rather than gopher wood, and the Titanic was built to house, to carry 3,547 people and enough food and water for 2 weeks, whereas the Ark was expected to hold 8 people, 17,400 birds, 12,000 reptiles, 9,000 mammals, 5,000 amphibians, and 2 million insects, plus enough food and water for a year. Which, according to the people that like to post this picture and forward the website, that would give approximately 6.5 millimeters, cubic millimeters per animal of space within the ark. Well, there's significant problems with their ciphering, though, that we'll get to. First of all, aside from the fact that the actual dimensions are probably off some, according to answers in Genesis, they say that the size of the ark was more likely 510 feet by 85 by 51, which would make it somewhat more along the same size as the Titanic, especially when you think when they measure the Titanic's height, they're counting the smoke tax as well, which is almost half of the height of it. It wouldn't have required that many animals either. For example, let's say that we wanted to make sure that our dog Tucker survives the flood, okay? And so we want to make sure that his lineage goes on, you know? Would we need to get a boy Tucker and a girl Tucker, Tuckerette, to go on the ark? Would that be something we'd have to do? Well, modern biology has taken the animal kingdom and divided it, actually all living things, the whole biology, which means the study of living things, has taken all of biology and divided it into seven different groups. You've got kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, and species. Now, Tucker would be classified as an animal. The chordata would be his phylum. He is a vertebrate. He's a mammal. That would be his class. His order would be Carnivora. He's a carnivore. He is a carnivore. His family would be Canidae, and his genus would be Canis, and his species is eating pooping machine. Okay, that's what he would be. Now, if in order to actually what would have to be on the ark in order to ensure that Tucker would be around today would just simply be on the family level, that he would be a canine. He would be of the family Canidae. 5,000 years of inbreeding since then has produced Tucker. You know, so, and you could, some animals, they would be divided on the genus level, but we're not talking about species when he says two of each kind. The word kind in the Bible is closer to the man-made designation of family. And so you had two of each family, two of each dog, two of each cat, two of each cow, so on and so forth. And that would change the number of animals that would be needed to be on the voyage dramatically. I mean, you would probably have somewhere, instead of the millions that the skeptics come up with, you need somewhere south of 20,000 different animals. In fact, probably 16,000 is more accurate kinds or families of animals that would be needed. And this would be accounting for Mr. and Mrs. Cat and Mr. and Mrs. Dog and so forth. Also, the average adult animal size, if you look at the animal kingdom in whole, the average animal size is about the size of a sheep. So that's presuming that they took only adult-sized animals on the ark. You know, they could have been babies. In the case of insects, they could have actually been eggs or larvae or something to that degree. And then also, it's also assuming that not only were they full-grown animals that they brought onto the ark, but it's also assuming that they were awake and active the whole time that they were on the ark. And there's nothing that would prevent God from causing some sort of hibernation, suspended animation for most of the animals, and that would make the care and the cleaning up of the animals a whole lot easier. And most of the supposed anti-flood criticism is based upon an antediluvian understanding of how things work. You know, we understand how, for example, how fast wood will rot in water based upon how fast wood rots in water today. But that may have been a whole different condition before the flood. You know, I was reading this one site, website that said it took Noah over 100 years to build the ark. The word that he started with in the beginning would already begin to rot by the time he got to the end of it. Well, that's assuming that wood rotted the same way that wood rots today. Here's a proposed cross-section also from Answers in Genesis that's looking from the front view of the ark, cutting it in half. And these two center sections would be where the animals would be housed. And then the two outer parts on the port and starboard side, little naval lingo there, the port and starboard side of the boat. It's really not really accurate to call it a boat. It was more of a barge. And that's why the comparison between it and any other floating vessel is kind of inaccurate, because the ark wasn't designed to sail. It was designed to float. That was its only purpose. It wasn't designed to go somewhere. Aerodynamics and buoyancy was the only consideration. It didn't have anything to do with aerodynamics. And most experts say that the definitive work on, if you want to read more of it, I haven't read the book myself, but there's a book by a guy by the name of John Woodmorapi, who did this book a few years ago called Noah's Ark, a Feasibility Study. And most people say that this is the, just, that explains it all very much in detail. And it came to pass, verse 10, after 7 days, that the waters of the flood were on the earth. And in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month. Now, this is considered to be day one of the deluge, the day that they went into the ark. And it would be, here's a chart that I made up. I'll probably reference it again next time when we cover the time that they're actually in the ark in the flood. But it's going to be from the day that Noah and his family went into the ark and God sealed up the door until the day that they walked off, 377 days. Until they touch on terra firma again. I believe the earth was universal, and I believe that getting the animals in there and feeding them for that over a year had not been that difficult at all. Here's a couple of evidences that I just threw at you. These are kind of easy things to remember as to why I believe that the earth, or that the flood, was about 5,000 years ago. One is the water erosion from major waterfalls. We can measure the rate of waterfalls, of the weight of erosion. We can measure the water that's going over the edge. And, for example, Niagara Falls loses about 4 to 5 inches of edge every year from the erosion of the waters it goes over. We can measure it from the time we started. We can go from the time we started measuring it back in the 1800s until today, and we can see that's been a constant kind of 4 to 5 inches. And assuming that that's true, that it's been constant since the flood, it only goes back to about a maximum of 7,000 years. But I would think that after the flood and the ice age and the resulting ice age and everything, that would have made the original deluge, or the flood, the waterfall going over the edge, would have been much more rapid and much more destructive in the beginning than what it is now, and so probably a greater rate of erosion, which would lower the time life of Niagara Falls significantly. And then the silt deposits in the major rivers, where the rivers dump out into the ocean. Every major river where they empty in the ocean, they have this delta that's formed. We had the Mississippi River Delta. You've got the land of Goshen in Egypt where the Nile deposits. And in every major river, there is that. And ancient maps, here's a picture of the Tigris and Euphrates Delta has filled in at least 150 miles of silt since the original days of the early maps. And here you can see they believe that in the earlier maps of antiquity, that showed the Persian Gulf extending all the way up to Ur, the Chaldees, where Abraham came from. And that's 150 miles from where the Persian Gulf is now. So in the last 2,000 years, we could say, or 1,000 years, however the oldest maps are, it's filled in 150 miles. I mean, if we're going to add like all the tens of thousands of years that they say that the localized flood of antiquity was, the Persian Gulf wouldn't exist anymore. It would already been filled up with silt. So that's another reason why I think it's probably, as the Bible would time it, roughly around 5,000 years. He goes on to say, on that day, all the foundations of the great deep were broken up and all the windows of heaven were open. And the rain was on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. So all these subterranean waters were released that had been captured underneath the earth. The earth was relatively flat before that. But when all of this cataclysmic upheaval and all this big gush of water, not only coming from the sky, but also coming from under the ground as well, creating these cavities under the crust of the earth that the water was so heavy on that it pressed down on, forming the oceans and all the great oceanic mountains that exist today that are much higher than Everest. But then also there was this upheaval of push of volcanoes and all this going on at the same time, which caused the mountain ranges that we see today. And the volcanoes could have been very much in used by God in triggering the rain on a natural, naturalistic vantage. And on that very day, verse 13, Noah and Noah's sons and Ham and Shem and Japheth and Noah's wife and the three wives entered the ark. And they kept every beast after its kind and all cattle after their kind and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth after its kind and every bird after its kind and every bird of every sort. And they went into the ark to Noah, two by two, of all flesh which is in which is the breath of life. And so those that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. You know, the Lord shut the door. I mean, they didn't have to remember, did you lock the door? No, I thought you were going to lock the door. You know, they didn't have to go through that whole thing and then get up in the middle of the night and go check the door, because the Lord did it. The Lord locked him in, and there was only one door. You know, just as there was one door to escape the judgment of that era, so is there one door to escape the judgment of this one. The door then was the ark of the door of the ark. The door now, of course, is Jesus. And the flood was on the earth for 40 days. And the waters increased and lifted up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. And the waters prevailed greatly, increased on the earth, and greatly increased on the earth, and the ark moved about on the surface of the waters. That was what it was designed to do, was float. And so it floated. And the waters prevailed exceedingly on the earth, and all the high hills under the whole earth were covered, and the waters prevailed 15 cubits upward, and the mountains were covered. I wonder, just kind of as we wrap it up, just be somewhat of a poignant reflection, I think. I wonder at what point the jeers, you know, you boat-thumping fundamentalists, you know, and just all the laughing and joking they made of Noah and his sons. I wonder when those jeers turned into cries, and when the catcalling and the joking turned into the scratching and the knocking on the door. You know, all scientists agree there was some kind of flood. They will disagree on the universality of it, but like, as I said, there's upwards of 240 flood stories in various cultures. And so all flesh died that moved on the earth, birds and cattle and beasts and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth and every man, in all whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life, all that was on the dry land died. And he destroyed all living things which were on the face of the ground, both man and cattle, creeping thing, and birds of the air. Some of those creeping things, I just kind of wish maybe they hadn't got on the ark. You know what I'm saying? But they probably would have microevolution produced them anyway. And so they were all destroyed. And only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive. And the waters prevailed 150 days. So I think we could very accurately and literally say the ark was a zoo. Let's pray.